It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for joining us this morning. As concern surrounding the threat of climate change grows, there's been a growing interest in a shift to renewable energy infrastructure. Here are some statistics. According to the U.S. Energy Information Association, renewable energy accounted for 10% of the power created in Wisconsin in 2020. Most of the renewable energy comes from hydropower and windmills, with less than 0.5% coming from utility and small-scale solar combined. That said, the majority of energy in the state produced last year was still generated from coal, natural gas, and nuclear energy. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about renewable energy infrastructure? Are you hopeful we'll be able to find enough to wean off of fossil fuels, build enough of that infrastructure? And do you have solar panels on your home or business? And how can renewable energy be made more accessible? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Greg Nemeth. He is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He teaches courses in policy analysis, energy systems, and international environmental policy. Greg, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, good morning. It's good to be here.
So there are right now a few different strategies being used to transition to renewable energy sources. Can you break those down for us?
Well, what we're seeing are, you know, we had been seeing policy driving renewables. So we had in our state, 10% of electricity had to be met by renewables in 2015. That was set in 2005, and we met that. But since then, we've been stalled at around, as you said, around the same level, around 10%. But in the meantime, we've had much more private sector activity just wanting to build new renewables because they're inexpensive, because customers are starting to demand them, and also because there's some anticipation that in the longer term, maybe not that long, maybe a few years, we're going to need to have way less fossil fuel emissions, and renewables are a good solution to that. So it's really been driven by multiple factors lately. And so I think what we're starting to see is a second resurgence in our state to kind of catch up with the rest of the country and what's happening in the rest of the world.
Now, let's look at Wisconsin specifically. What does Wisconsin's energy grid look like overall?
Yeah, I think traditionally, and this was just a few years ago, you could have said most, like literally most, more than half of our electricity was coming from coal. And that's not true anymore. We've really started to shut down coal plants in the last several years. Surprisingly to many, because some of these plants were not that old. Some were built in the 1980s, which could have still had more years to run, but they're too expensive to run compared to the alternatives, compared to running natural gas fired power plants or running wind or building wind and solar. And so that's been a big change in Wisconsin. And it's probably surprised most people that we're really switching away from coal and having more renewables and more natural gas. So that's been the big shift.
Now, our neighbor to the west, Minnesota, has taken advantage of a lot of the medium scale community solar. First, can you break down what community solar is versus, you know, smaller scale operations?
Yeah. So you can think about small scale is that's a rooftop solar installation. And that's pretty clear. And then what we've had in the last 5 or 10 years around the country and in a couple places in our state are large scale solar, where it approximates the size of a traditional coal or gas power plant. So those are really large fields or solar farms, sometimes called. Then there's this real sweet spot in between, which is called community solar. And there we might have the equivalent of 200 people's roofs together in one spot. And you might have it in a brownfield, on top of a warehouse, on the side of an airport, those types of places. And they're not massive where it dominates the whole landscape, but they do take advantage of one of the key assets of large-scale solar, which is inexpensive. So there's some economies of scale and some costs that are spread when you do these larger facilities. And community-scale solar, say like 200 times one rooftop, works pretty well with that. And then you can get people to subscribe and get some of their or all of their electricity from one of those community installations. And Minnesota has gone big on that in the last decade. And we're just starting to, and now there's a docket at the PSC on that as well. And that could really open up some possibilities for people to attain solar that can't do it because they have shaded roofs or live in apartments or things like that. So I think that's what's really shown to work pretty well in Minnesota. And I think that'll work pretty well here in Wisconsin as well.
So I just cited some statistics from the U.S. Energy Information Association that said that 0.5% of solar power, that makes up 0.5% of the 10% of renewable energy in Wisconsin. Why are we so behind on solar in particular?
Yeah, so we're behind other places, partly because we have less sunshine. That's pretty obvious. But just to be clear, it's about a factor of two difference between the sunniest places in the U.S., so Arizona and Southern California in here. So, you know, that means the same solar panel is going to generate half as much electricity. And if you're going to put that into dollar terms, like what our electricity bill will look like, that same installation will be twice as expensive in Wisconsin as it is in other places. So you would expect it to be less, but we shouldn't be that much less than, say, our neighbors with a similar solar resource like Minnesota. And so we have been behind on that. But it really does seem like we're starting to catch up. If you look at, you know, there's a regional organization that manages a transmission. And if you're going to build a new large power plant, you have to file with them to make sure that there's an adequate transmission and it's sited in the right place. And the last time I looked at that, there were 30 large solar farms plan to go in Wisconsin. Maybe not all of those will happen, but some will be added that aren't there now. And, you know, that would really transform from the two we have today to something like 30. So we're behind, and that 0.5% you mentioned, you know, represents where we are. And, you know, the whole world is at 3% solar. So we're behind the rest of the world, not just our neighbors to the west. But, you know, the key thing to think about is these numbers here are growing quickly. And so if you're growing, as solar has been overall for the last 30 years, at 30% a year, that means every about 3 years, we're doubling the amount of solar. And so that 0.5% could get up to something much more substantial, you know, if we just grow at the rate that the rest of the world is growing. So I think we're actually likely to see quite a bit more solar in our state in the near future.
We're talking to Greg Nemet right now, a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He teaches courses in policy analysis, energy systems, and international environmental policy. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Lily in Dodgeville. Hi, Lily.
Hi, good morning. Under this Wisconsin State Statute 196.3784GE, the Wind Siting Council is supposed to meet every 5 years and send a report to the chief clerk of each house of the legislature. However, there has been no meeting or report since 2014. The PSC 128 is out of date. It doesn't cover the large-scale green energy projects. It only covers small-scale. While there is a large scale wind project currently trying to gain ground here in Iowa and Lafayette counties, which will have 3.5 megawatt wind turbines that are 695 feet tall. While Wisconsin farms are being overrun by large scale green energy utility projects, the Wind Siting Council is AWOL. As Greg is on the Wind Siting Council, why has the council not met since 2014?
Thank you, Lily, for that call. Your response, Greg?
Yeah, you're right. I'm on the council. I was joined last year. We haven't met. I'm not sure when we will meet. I would love to meet and discuss these issues with the rest of the council, because the siting is such a crucial issue. And it's been true all along of things like pipelines and power lines and coal power plants and gas power plants and renewables in the same way, for different reasons, but the aesthetics, the impacts on landscapes are crucial. And those are things we need to work out. And I'm very much a big advocate of, you know, deliberative processes here, of having public comment and thinking through the pros and cons. And so I would very much welcome more, you know, public engagement and also that council being active in how things are cited. And I agree. I think, you know, part of the reason to your previous question is why we have so little solar and wind is because we haven't had a really active, helpful, healthy process of public deliberation about siting. And I think that's probably why we have less than other places have. Because my thinking is that you can cite things well and you can cite things badly. It's not just yes or no. And so doing things like citing solar plants behind hedgerows and behind rows of trees, a little bit out of sight, similar with wind farms. There's things that you can do that, you know, don't make them invisible, but make them much more fitting with this, you know, gorgeous, beautiful landscapes that we have in our state. And I very much hope we can do more with that.
Thank you for that call, Lily. Now, Greg, this is not the switch to renewables is not just a Wisconsin issue. It's something that is being considered at the national level. Lawmakers in D.C. have reached a deal on an infrastructure package. The bill hasn't passed yet, and it certainly has been signed into law. But that proposal includes $73 billion for new power lines. What is the goal in these lines, and how much renewables are going to be part of this?
Yeah, so one enables the other. So transmission power lines allows for more renewables. And, you know, as we get from 10% renewables like we have in our state and what the world has to levels that are much higher like other countries have, there's countries that produce more than 100% of their electricity from renewables and have to export some of it. And as you start to get to more and more renewables, you start to say, oh, it's not just about siting or just about policy and incentives. It's how do you manage a power grid where the power is not on and off when you want it, but it's on and off when the wind wants to blow or the sun wants to shine. And so there's several different things you can do to make a grid handle large numbers of renewables, like maybe 80 or 90% renewables. You know, you have different renewables. You can have solar and wind. That's one. You can have demand response, like yesterday I allowed MG&E to turn up my thermostat so there wasn't air conditioning because they needed extra power in the afternoon. So that can help quite a bit. You can have storage like batteries or other types of storage around the system to have energy available when it's needed, not just when it's produced, and information technology throughout. But the main thing that can make high amounts of renewables possible is connecting renewables to each other, connecting supply of wind and solar to where the demand is, because that happens in different places and different over different times. And so the more you can move electricity around, the more flexibility there is. And so that's a big motivation for why we would have $70 or $80 billion going into building new transmission, is it to enable much more renewables. If renewables are a big part of how we get to zero carbon dioxide emissions by 2050. So that it really fits together with more renewables needs more transmission.
We're talking to Greg Nemeth right now. He's a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He teaches courses in policy analysis, energy systems, and more. And he's with us to talk about the future of renewable energy. And in just a minute, we'll talk about large-scale versus regional grids. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about renewable energy, from growing interest in alternative energy to apprehension about the switch to renewables. And we're taking your calls. Are there solar and wind farms in your area? What can you share about that experience? Do you support building large transmission lines to get energy from renewable sources to urban areas? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Greg Nemeth stays with us. He's a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison and specializes in energy policy, among many other things. Now, Greg, one of the other things that we've been seeing a lot of right now are issues with grids. And there's been some pushback to this idea of a grid development authority. Why do some folks favor smaller regional energy systems versus larger scale projects?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's really like two kind of models of how the energy system should work that have kind of been in place since like Thomas Edison more than 120 years ago. And, you know, one idea is bigger is better. So centralized generation, more connectivity. It's all one big system that can work together. We've shown we can do that in the past. And that's how you get lots of diverse demand together and lots of diverse supply sources like wind and renewables together. And that's one model of thinking. And then the other model, I would go back to a book I read back in school called Small is Beautiful. This idea that small scale is more human scale. You can have it designed exactly for the way people produce it. You give people autonomy. They can produce their own power, not just be purchasers of it. If you give them, say, solar panels and then a battery in their basement or garage, then they can even start to market power and sell it when it's valuable and save it when they actually need it. So, you know, on one hand, there's kind of more like the physics and the system that where big tends to work better. And then there's the other hand, there's the small scale where autonomy, being able to kind of be your own boss about how you make and use energy has some appeal. And that has some appeal at a few different levels. There's the household level that I just described. You can also think about businesses or schools kind of producing their own power. Then you might have communities that have can work with microgrids where you'd have maybe like a block that kind of has their own mini power system. And then you've got, you know, states like Texas as an example where they created their own electric grid that has very few connections to the outside for similar reasons of autonomy. And so there's a few different models out there. And it's interesting to me how they can actually kind of work together. And if you get it right, you get some of the benefits of the small combined with the benefits of the large at the same time.
Now, you just referenced Texas, and we saw how their energy grid fared this winter. Is there some, in part because it almost entirely went down, are we concerned a little bit about that sort of autonomous grid being an issue for other areas?
Well, I would if there were examples of it. Texas is an extreme example. Like, they've really, you know, they're not an island, but they act as if they are. Like, they've designed their grid and their regulatory authority as if they are. They have their own transmission authority, and it's not connected to the outside except for a few links. And so when something, so in a lot of ways, they have plenty of energy. They have tons of wind power, tons of natural gas. And so they're almost never going to have a problem where they don't have enough energy. And that's been a reason why they wanted to just have their own system all on their own. But, you know, once in a while you have an extreme event, and that's what happened last February when you had this extended cold period. And, you know, it wasn't that cold compared to what we experience, and our, you know, electric grid and natural gas system and power plants are just fine when it's minus 20, below outside. But Texas has not been designed that well that way. They've been designed to operate, with just, you know, once in a while, a few cold places. But this was cold for a week, and it was much colder than they're used to. And so they had gas lines not operating anymore, losing pressure, power plants that couldn't operate of various kinds, especially natural gas power plants, but also their nuclear plants had to stop for a little bit, and some of their wind power was less productive. And so, it all came together at one period. And that's the kind of thing where bigger is better, because when you're linked to the outside, you can start importing power or natural gas when you need it. And so in our state, we're much more connected to the rest of the country, the rest of the Midwest. And so we're in a better situation because of that. And so I think, yeah, we would not have those situations. Plus, we're used to dealing with, you know, really cold weather. So it's not a problem. But, you know, with a changing climate, we could have other situations that we're not used to, maybe really extended and intense hot weather or dry or really excessively wet periods. And those are likely to be more common as we have more extremes in our weather.
We're talking to Greg Nemeth right now, a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Alan in Dodgeville. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. How ironic that this morning's program, the previous program, had to do with how the wealthy got rich. The present system that we have for planning, whether that's at the state level, it was mentioned about wind siting. There's no solar siting. But when you look into the componentries of who sits on those panels, it's all based against small people. It's for only the rich to take advantage of these systems. For example, in Iowa County, if you want to build a doghouse, a proverbial doghouse, you've got to go through zoning with the local officials back and forth. It takes months and months. But if you want to put up an industrial-sized solar a farm that is 10,000 acres, which we do have by Cobb, the local people have no voice in that. If you want to put up a 700, 800-foot tall windmill and place them all around your property, you have no voice against that.
Alan, thank you so much for that call. You know, Greg, we only have about a minute left. What's your response to the community having a say in some of these farms that are built?
Yeah, you know, I think what it all comes down to, really, almost all of it comes down to the Public Service Commission. That is this state regulatory agency that not many people think about. And it's, you know, that is where a lot of these decisions get made, both systemic ones about what the process is when you have to or when you want to install something new, but also on case-by-case basis, like if there's a new power line. So, you know, that's the place where there should be more public comment. And I wish more people would pay attention to the cases that are happening there. You know, there's this new issue on community solar being raised there. I would very much encourage Caller and others to take a look at that and maybe attend the meetings and get engaged, because that's exactly where we need to put some of these voices.
Greg, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Greg Nemeth is a professor in the LaFollette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about renewable energy. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with an ode to a beloved first home.
Nigel and Amy O'Shea bought their first home in Madison in 2013. Now, they're departing Wisconsin after 15 years of building a life here. Nigel wanted to pay one last tribute to the house that he is so sad to leave behind.
11 steps to the basement, high above Beld Street. The prow of our ship, a two-bedroom bungalow. In the tides of traffic and the occasional train, our house is barely a skiff on the river system of Park Street. Among the buckthorn kept for the hammock, the spring lilac and the juniper, and Lou Reed, the tree stretching towards our power lines, there's Wingra and U-Haul and Arby's, its masthead light fading red, taunting convenience. Beyond it, the weather station hexagon sits on cream brick like a northwestern moon. The north adjacent lot is empty and unprotected, but for a gray breakwater wall holding in the seasons. When the grass grows, when the snow heaps, from shovel and mower, from mud to clover. A leaky aft porch where we sup in the summer will again see places set for starlight. As the snowmelt drinks wake the dead trees, spring hoists the green sails aloft, tying them to earth with flowers. Daffodil pegs and tulip cleats hug bebom planks. Aloft, the curtains tug east and frame the view from our decks. Cats always watching or sleeping. Beld Street cresting and crashing day into night. The shouting air shakes with cars booming their long Doppler wakes, receding into the horizon, red as hell. A heat we only imagined in our fireplace because it never got a chance to char embers. Sometimes, time sometimes gets frozen in hot sunset during our moorage of counting days. Tidy but scuffed, this house is steered by ghosts. Our kitchen and orange galley clanking at all hours, and we are the current crew. When the bell sounds and we go below deck, let's hope we left it for the better. Good neighbors until eternity's end.
Nigel, Amy, and their daughter Flora O'Shea traded their two-bedroom bungalow in Madison for a Toyota RV. They're heading west towards family and into the sunset. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Now, the House Select Committee investigating the violent riot at the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th began its hearings this week. So far, the committee has heard testimony from Capitol police officers who recounted in gut-wrenching details the fear and violence they experienced that day.
I, too, was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die, defending this entrance.
That's Army veteran and U.S. Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gonnell testifying on Tuesday. He's one of four officers recounting their experiences. And we want to hear from you. How did you react to hearing the testimony this week? What takeaways did you have about the Capitol attack? And what would you like to see accomplished by this investigation? Call 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Karen Greenberg. She's a historian, professor, and author. She's also the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law and an international studies fellow at New America. She hosts the Vital Interest podcast. Karen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
So bring us up to speed. What has happened since the Capitol attack on January 6th?
That's a really good and broad question. I know some people think like so little has happened, but the larger story of what's happened is that the election results continue to be challenged, which is very much at the heart of the story of the Capitol riots, which were the Save the Steal, right riots, or insurrection. So that's been going on as a continuum. So too have a number of attempts at court challenges to the election results. In addition to that, Congress and Nancy Pelosi have been trying to put together some kind of committee or commission to look into this. This started with the idea of an independent commission, but has resulted, as you know, in a Senate select, in a select committee to look at what happened during the Capitol riots. And there are a number of things that they're trying to get to the bottom of. First is what happened, who said what to whom, who gave what commands, who was in charge of this, what was the chain of command, how did this happen, as well as what happened. And then there's a part of this is what did not happen. How come federal law enforcement, local law enforcement, state law enforcement. There are so many different entities that are charged with protecting Washington, D.C., and they didn't show up. And the question is why? And we've seen bits and pieces of that from stories about trying to call in the National Guard and the message not getting transmitted and the decision not being made. But it's a much broader story than that. And then I think the third part of what this is all going to be about has to do with what will be the upshot of this? What will be the upshot of finding out that certain orders were given or not given? And that has to go to accountability. And so that's a further mark or a further goal. But I think that's all that's what's at stake in what is happening right now. And since the insurrection, this has been the story that they've been trying to get happen. Can we get some sort of hearing, some sort of investigation, some sort of truth telling about the narrative of that day going? And the hearings this week were a sign that it started finally.
Now, Karen, the committee tasked with the investigation held its first meeting on Tuesday, as we said. Committee members heard four officers who were defending the Capitol on January 6th. And I want to take a listen to one of them. Here is Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn on what happened as rioters entered the Capitol building.
More and more insurrectionists were pouring into the area by the Speaker's lobby near the rotunda, and some wearing MAGA hats and shirts that said Trump 2020. I told them to just leave the Capitol, and in response, they yelled, "No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here."
That was Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn. He is a Black American. He also recounted how rioters called him and other officers racial slurs during you know, the height of this riot. Karen, what is the committee hoping to learn from the testimony from not only Officer Dunn, but others?
Well, I think I want to just talk about why they opened with these statements. I think one of the things they wanted to do in beginning this way was sort of set the tenor of what was at stake here. This isn't just about the election. This is about these deeper seated tensions that are, you know, dividing America right now, among them race, among them the use of the presidency to foment, you know, racial division as well as political division. And so I think they want, and they wanted to set it with, give it an emotional setting. And I think that when you play that, and there's other parts of the testimonies you could have played that set the stage for just how emotional this was and getting to the core of some of the essential values of how we think of our democracy. And so, I mean, I think those two clips were very important in that way. The other thing you know is that Donald Trump is likely going to be central to this committee's questions and maybe to many of the answers. I mean, it wasn't just the wearing of the MAGA hats, the MAGA paraphernalia, but it was also the direct reference to President Trump invited us here. And so I think that was the stage, that's why they asked these individuals to testify. And I think the final thing is, look, these are police officers, the Capitol police officers, and there's been so much controversy in the middle of this partisan divide in this country lately about cops with the defund the police and the investigations that are going on into white supremacy within police across the country. The idea that these were police who were doing their job, who were attacked, is actually a very important moment here, so that they're sort of providing a sort of politically safe space to talk about how important it was that these officers not be assaulted the way they were.
Yeah, and just to second that, we know from other testimony, including Sergeant Aquilino Gonel, who we heard just a few minutes ago, he also recounted being called a traitor by some of the rioters, and that if, you know, basically if the officers weren't on the side of the rioters, that they were against President Trump and the election. So, Karen, how do you see sort of public reaction to this testimony?
You know, it's very interesting. It's hard to exactly get a beat on that this early. I think the public reaction has been, I mean, you know, it depends on who you're reading, right? But the public reaction very much seems to have been, I think, a little surprised in really trying to focus on what this was all about. There's been a way in which, although the courts and the Department of Justice and a number of other, you know, official places have been paying attention to what happened in the insurrection, it's sort of fallen out of the mainstream, given what's happening with COVID, given a few other things that have happened within the executive branch over these past few months as this administration takes hold. And so I think part of it was really just trying to say, let's remember what happened. And I think the reaction among the public was, oh, yes, we do remember. This is not okay. And it's very important that this be handled in an exquisitely procedural way, that it doesn't descend to the kind of emotions that can happen and that have been happening in the public sphere since the insurrection. In other words, trying as best as possible, which will be hard, to minimize the pure, a sense of pure partisanship about this. And so I think that's also a very important part of this. I just want to put a little carve out here to say that that's also what the courts are considering. They consider that they too, as they look through these cases, as they bring these cases to the fore, as they're doing these more than 500 cases so far, with hundreds more to come, we're told, they see it as their role, should any of these cases come to trial or even in the filings, that the facts are presented, that there is a narrative of what happened that presented. So you're actually getting two strains of telling the public, which will eventually have to react to pieces and the whole of this, what happened.
We are talking about the House committee charged with investigating the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol and what we've heard so far in the early days of testimony. Our guest is Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. We're taking your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're talking about the latest news tied to the investigation underway into the violent January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. Karen Greenberg is our guest. She's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law and an International Studies Fellow at New America. And you're invited to join the conversation. What reflections do you have about the Capitol attack almost 7 months later? How do you think this affects our democracy, and what needs to happen to restore trust in the government? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Now, looking at the hearings so far this week, what has stood out to you about the testimony or even what we've heard from members of the committee?
You know, what stood out is something to reference to the thing you just said about trusting government, that what's at the core of this is an attempt not just to punish, not just to tell the story, but to understand that telling the story and getting the facts are restoring trust in government. And it's interesting that the officers that were called to testify seem to be asking for that same thing. What did they say? We want to get to the bottom of this. We want to know what happened. And part of that is, why did our government fail us? Why were we not helped? Why were we not able to protect these individuals? One of the things that's come out of both the hearing and sort of the reporting around the hearing is also the way in which the Capitol Police were not trained in the right way for this kind of event, were not equipped with the right kind of equipment or knowing how to use that right kind of equipment. So in addition to all of the other factors that may come about, it highlights the fact that there were vulnerabilities for this kind of event. So it's restoring trust in government and restoring trust in the need to keep constant oversight over how our government functions, how it trains, how it has best practices. So it is a much larger story than just even the insurrection itself. And I think that your reference to trust in government is really much what's going on here. And it can accomplish that.
Now, this committee has not been without controversy. There are many lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, who don't think that this committee is, as bipartisan as it could be. You know, U.S. Representative Brian Steil shared his thoughts on the House investigation on The Morning Show yesterday. Here he is.
And I think that the fact that Nancy Pelosi removed two Republicans from that committee, refused to allow them on the committee, maybe better said, is a real show that this is going to be a more of a partisan process.
So we're hearing from Representative Brian Steil there. And, you know, earlier you were saying that this needs to be as procedural as possible. Do you think that these calls of partisanship are going to cloud some of the proceedings?
It may. I think one of the biggest, you know, burdens on Congress is to behave in a way that is not as nonpartisan as possible. But there's no getting around the fact that this is a story about an attempt at a political coup. And so you're going to hear this kind of thing. To the remarks of Steil, I just want to say that remember that Jim Jordan, one of the people that Nancy Pelosi didn't allow on the committee, may very well end up being somebody who's called in to testify as a witness. So just to say there are other reasons it's not going to be an apolitical hearing. This is about politics. This is about what happened with an attempt to not certify the vote for president. So there will be complications like that. I think that the committee just has to go ahead, do its best to not succumb to any kind of political outburst. But this is a political story, and there will there's going to be that kind of allegation around it. I think the losers will be those who decide not to participate in the events and not to pay attention, because this hearing is going forward, and the American public are going to see it, they're going to hear it, and there will be fixes made within government because of it. And you saw that the Department of Justice this week issued a couple of decisions, one about no executive immunity when it comes to the hearings, and the other about no federal employee immunity. So I would expect the next step will be that individuals will be subpoenaed and brought in for what I expect to be August hearings. So despite allegations of partisanship, this will go forward. And the Department of Justice, for its role, is taking a very strong stand that information witnesses need to be allowed to come forward.
We're talking to Karen Greenberg right now. She's an expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties. Karen, how do you think this investigation and findings will affect our democratic system as a whole?
It could have a very good outcome. It could be a reset to things that have gotten out of hand, not just during the insurrection, but in years past, what is the division between the Department of Justice and the White House? Can the White House order the Department of Justice to do things that violate law, norms, and policies? So that's one particular thing. Two, do we respect our election process, and can it be challenged to the point where it no longer accords with the facts? Three, do we have a Congress that can address crises, trauma, and more and harm that's been done to the system? So I see this as a very important moment for reset, for accountability within government, for clarifying the role of the White House vis-a-vis the rest of the executive. These are all things that have been long attended to since before President Trump, who just exploited many of these vulnerabilities. So I think the outcome of this could be extremely important for restoring not just trust in government, but actual principled functioning and lawful functioning of government.
We only have about 30 seconds left, Karen. You know, kind of brass tacks, we're going to probably be seeing subpoenas soon. Who do you think the committee is going to start calling to testify?
They may call Jeff Rosen. They may call Mark Meadows. I do think they're going to want to perhaps talk to President Trump. I don't think that'll happen in the initial stages. I think they'll build a case first, but who knows? So I think some of the top people within the government will be the next ones that are called. They may also talk to some people that were have already been indicted, that have already settled their cases, just to get them on the record in terms of what they were told, why they were there, who gave them the orders. I think this could be a rather vast set of characters that will be subpoenaed, but I guess we'll see.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Karen Greenberg is a historian, professor, and author. She is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law and an international studies fellow at New America. She hosts the Vital Interest podcast, and she joined us to talk about that select House committee investigating the January 6th riots. Just ahead, U.S. gymnast Simone Biles bowed out of some Olympic events this week, citing her mental health and concern that she could get injured as a result of the pressure. We talk to an expert about how stress, anxiety, and doubt can impact performance. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.